Okay, so continuing with Michael Large on 16 March 78. Were there any results published after 1960 that you did a jodrell?
There were two papers on the Milky Way. We surveyed Haslam and I, and Sigmund had joined at that stage. And we surveyed the galactic chain at 408.
Now, there was a Dutch survey about this time also, wasn't there?
There was a Westerhout survey too, and there were one or two other surveys. There was a chain survey in Australia, apart from the galactic chain. And we got around the idea of doing a bit more astronomy then, and we really made a fairly detailed comparison of our survey with the other surveys that had been published, and picked up the spectrum, the emission that identifies thermal and non-thermal sources in the galaxy. And I think that was quite an important piece of work. It's been superseded now, of course, but at the time it was quite important because there were people around who still didn't believe that Professor Mill's survey of the galaxy was right. And
why was that?
Perhaps the most useful. Oh, I think he's in Australia and he thought of it had Sunnyside low.
Yeah, yeah.
It hadn't been done in Cambridge. Yes. Okay. Well, I mean, they didn't trust his work on the number counts of the radio sources.
Right. So that rubbed off on everything else.
Yeah, of course. Now, what we did, one of the things we did with the Jodrell Bank telescope was just drive it down the chain of the galaxy.
Yes.
All the way down. It got one long scan, it ran out about 50 feet of chart record. Just a long vehicle zork, the thing sort of went up and down on the sources. And we sent a copy over to Australia, to Professor Mill. And he was very interested in this, in fact, because he could compare it directly with his map at 85 from
right.
the and we had some correspondence with him about that. I think we've, if the differences were just due to differences in spectrum, there was nothing wrong with them.
Mm-hmm.
Then we published that paper on the spectrum of the sources of the galactic spectrum, which was, it wasn't a world-shattering paper, it was quite a useful contribution. Then we went on after that to investigate the spur. There was a lot of interest at the time in the North Polar Spur and and subsequently various other galactic spurs.
Right.
And one contribution which I felt we made, and I don't know to what extent it's really been followed up, we showed they were very circular. We were the first people to project them on a stereographic projection, where circles are projected as circles. And we showed that the North Polar Spur and also one of the southern spurs which we discovered were remarkably circular.
I see.
And those things are simply called loops. I think Haslam renamed them loop 1, loop 2, loop 3 or something.
Right. And once again, they've been...
The nomenclature, in my opinion, never mind. And John Meeburn in Manchester got very interested in the thing that we call the Cetus Arc. I think it's now called loop 2.
Right.
And... he was inspired by Hanbury Brown again. You'd be surprised how frequently Hanbury Brown comes into all these things.
Now, he's an optical astronomer, right?
What, Hanbury?
No, Meeburn.
Meeburn is. He was at the Department of Astronomy in Manchester.
Right, so you were in touch with the...
Yes, we were in touch with them, to some extent. Hanbury Brown more than any, and Rodney Davies was also in contact with us. Of course, we worked in there. We taught in the university 2 days a week.
Was this true even as early as 57, 58?
Yes, we all had... This was part of the problem. Our lives, as I mentioned, is terribly torn between teaching and research. More probably than in most university departments, because of this tremendous excitement of the place. We felt to me research was so important. It was probably just as well that we had to go into Manchester and devote them.
So
an entire 2 days to teaching, and took that off after.
And then 3 days out of Jodrell Bank.
Yeah, 3 days at Jodrell, two teaching.
Right.
Sometimes we manage to fiddle it and then do one day of work and one day of week teaching.
Right.
John Meeburn did hold some sky photographs of this region of the Cetus Arc and eventually found traces of filaments and so on.
I see.
I think it's most probably a supernova. I mean, it still isn't resolved what they are, these meters.
And then you came down in 63 to join Mills' group.
You can ask me reasons for that. I suppose some of the guilt was beginning to come off the gingerbread at Jodrell. The initial period of excitement was over. The promotion prospects and so on looked pretty dismal at Jodrell.
Mm-hmm.
England was going into a sort of depressed phase, and there were these tremendous opportunities in Australia.
Yeah.
And the combination of these things inspired me to write over and see what was going. And at that time, it was quite easy to come out in. They were looking for stuff. But I'd been working on the sort of things that Professor Norman was interested in, that the galactic survey.
Right, right.
Hanbury Brown came out with John Davis and Roy Allen on the optical side. And I'd heard a bit about what was going on out here, but I came out independently on them.
Yes. Let me just ask a general question about what would you say were the key ingredients for the successes of Jodrell Bank over the years?
What do you mean by successes? I mean,
the
impact of the place was almost entirely due to Professor Lovell. I mean, his inspiration, his determination, and so on.
And
getting the thing built.
And getting this huge instrument and so forth.
Hmm?
And getting this huge instrument realized.
His vision that the thing was necessary and could be built and could be used.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think one has to see that in perspective. It was very early for a big instrument like that.
Well, it was 50.
It really was a visionary.
Right, it was 51 or so when he first proposed it, yeah.
I think he made a series of correct decisions in the face of a lot of criticism.
Yes.
For example, I mentioned this decision to cut short the engineering work by taking down the scaffolding too soon has been widely criticized. But it was of key importance in getting the thing going.
It would have been about how much longer if he...
I think it was a question of 18 months or so.
I see.
It was a long time. And... all through, I mean, he was not a lot of opposition to what he was doing, but as far as keeping the instrument in the forefront and so on, he made the right decision.
But might not a lot more radio astronomy have come out of Jodrell if there hadn't been so much emphasis on space science and PR and
well,
so forth?
Well, the space science became necessary to finance it in the end. We were selling time on the telescope,
mm-hmm.
and it kept it in the public eye and kept the money coming in.
Why did it become necessary? I mean, other radio telescopes haven't had to do this.
Okay, well, we believed it was necessary. Well, partly because it was early, and it was expensive. You see, the Cambridge telescopes were very cheap,
I think. I see.
And he had to get money from somewhere. Something like £1 million it cost.
Yeah, right.
And the maintenance was expensive. And, of course, we had a lot of contracts with the American Armed Services. I mean, my work was supported by the Office of Naval Research, for example.
Right.
It was a bit, well, the money wasn't laughable, the money was good, the reports we had to send in were laughable.
Right.
I don't think they were ever read, the whole was touched in the form that they were sent after.
Yeah.
That was just manner, you know, that money, it was, we just thought the American Armed Services would just go on paying forever. This is roughly what they did, of course they've all dried up now.
This has always struck me as very...
naturally depended on
the This has always struck me as very strange to have the Office of Naval Research supporting radio astronomy around the world.
Well, they did.
In that era.
They supported it quite generously.
Oh, I know. But it's just indicative of some way the American military mind operates, or at least how it did in the 50s. Well, thank you very much. That's given me a good idea of your view of Jodrell at that time.
Well, I mean, probably if you talked to me for longer, I'd remember the various... experiment with the moon.
What year would this be now?
Hmm?
What year would this be?
I don't know. That must have been around 1960, I suppose. I can't
taste it. So Lovell and you were up in the swinging laboratory.
It's just an insight to his character more than anything else. The experiment's unimportant. In fact, it was a silly experiment. He wanted to get a voice contact with the moon with the lowest possible power transmitter.
I see.
Part of this thing about showing how powerful the Jodrell Bank telescope was, probably trying to get money from somewhere.
Right.
And, you know, he was up there with the microphone, he sat there and said, "Hello, moon." Wait for 2.5 minutes. And finally, he got frantic, you know, he was shouting and yelling, "Moon, answer me," you know.
Sounds like a scene out of Shakespeare's.
I think it's always the case when we either finally did or finally didn't get the moon or got some animal or something. He rang up and said, "My God, joy, tremendous, it's just like science fiction here." I think that's an insight.
Yes.
Excited by the whole setup of the thing.
Right, right. Sort of like with a big toy or something.
And there were a number of occasions. One time it was around about midnight one night when J.G. Davis and myself and Lovell and one of the other people sitting around talking. We've been doing some surveys, and there was some
some quarrel with husbands, you know, the engineers, the right. consulting engineers. And there was a real threat, apparently, that husbands were going to sue Lovell for £1 million.
Yes, at one stage, I think there was, yeah.
I was there when this personal came in, and he had to write... He had to write a letter of retraction to Republican Times for some statements he'd made, otherwise they'd sue him for £1 million. He was very angry about it. Hey, David, what shall I do? What shall I do? Shall I stand up? You know, he couldn't
yes.
be fine.
Yes.
Finally, he wrote the letter of retraction.
Yeah.
I forget what it was, he probably looked it up.
Well, it's probably in his book. I mean, he's told, from his point of view, this whole story.
But towards the end, I mean, more recently, I mean, now, there's always been a very remote atmosphere between Professor Lovell and the junior staff. You know, he'd keep himself very much aloof. He had his little private room and private garden. You couldn't talk to him.
Yeah.
Whereas Hanbury Brown, you could.
Yes, right.
And it resulted, when I was back there in 1970, and I think probably still now, in a very remote atmosphere. He'd lost a lot of friends, and the junior people were resentful, and they were being very unpleasant to him.
Yes.
I think that he's always been very kind to me. I mean, I have a great respect for Professor Lovell, and I'd hate to be quoted saying anything you know, against him. But that wasn't everybody's experience.
Yeah. Well, okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
That ends the interview with Michael Large on 16 March 78.